It's a great day to be a Manchester City fan.
It is.
Happy Monday. It's the Gab and Jules podcast. We're going to talk about Atalanta and Juventus. What we saw Saturday night was special.
Yeah.
Any which way you slice it. We're going to talk some North London derby.
Not so good in terms of quality. Not so good, but you know.
But there's one place to start. It's with CAS, the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne. Manchester City's two-year ban and 30 million euro fine have been overturned by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Instead, Manchester City are getting a 10 million euro fine for not cooperating with the investigators. Jules, yep. You have the perfect voice to be some Euro villain.
I'll try my best.
Give the reasons why. Give the reason that they did that.
The reasons.
Explanation.
As they explained, they emphasized that most of the alleged breaches reported by FFP, let's put it that way because it's less complicated, were either not established or time barred. That's what the CAS have judged. So they had 3 days with witnesses and expert and legal representatives of Manchester City and of Financial Fair Play, or the body that represents Financial Fair Play at UEFA. And they decided that, that the facts were not established or time barred.
For those who don't get that, there is a five-year limit on what cases can be, on when cases can be reopened. This is one of the central things. And what we don't know so far, we'll get Mark Ogden on in a second to help us out with this. What we don't know is the written reasons. Now, it says in there as well that they're going to divulge the full written award, right?
Yeah.
If this is the case, it's going to be in the next couple of days. If this is the case of somebody who's spent time on the CAS website, which actually makes for good reading. It's amazing. All this stuff is on there with a lot of detail. They will go into detail of this, and people will be able to form their own opinions.
Yeah, understand a bit better why.
Yeah, of which because simply were outside the statute of limitations, which then, you know, raises the question of why does UEFA bring a case on stuff that they can't prosecute, and which ones were not proven. So we'll get more detail. But for now, let's bring in Mark Ogden. Augie, the first instinct is on the football side. Obviously, this is a huge win for Manchester City. Pep Guardiola contract expires in 2021. He may choose to extend. Kevin De Bruyne had talked about possibly leaving. Football-wise, it's all good, right?
Yeah, football-wise, it's great. I mean, you know, like you say, Guardiola's future's secure, the players' future's secure, and they're back in the Champions League next season. And they've even got the great opportunity to go in next season as the Champions League winners if they can finish off the job in Lisbon. So from a football perspective, it's a great day for Man City. And, you know, who can complain if you're on the blue side of Manchester? No matter what the verdict says about time barred or, you know, other things not proven, I don't think anyone will care at City. I really don't. And I think from a football perspective too, it is time to move on because this now becomes an issue about UEFA's FFP rules and why they pursued it with a five-year time bar situation. Football-wise, City have won, move on.
Now, I'm not a lawyer here, but there are some situations, and again, this will emerge in the written reasons, where just simply because something is outside of the statute of limitations, if new evidence is introduced, it can still be reopened. Now, yeah. Obviously, in this case, the Court of Arbitration for Sport thought that this didn't apply here. Jules, do you feel that they are fully exonerated and they did nothing wrong? Or do you feel like, you know, this is a technicality that is getting them off?
I think it's a technicality. It's like if you go to court, but your lawyer finds some loophole somewhere or something that gone wrong in the investigation or in the files or whatever, and you get away with it. I feel it's like this. I think it makes an absolute joke of FFP. We've seen or we've read some of the Football League's email that were leaked by Football Leagues, and it looked quite damning, to be fair, to Man City. And I know they said they didn't cook the books, and they were quite aggressive in their response to the ban and also to what people were saying, and good on them. But the more, for me, the time-barred argument in this statement from CAS makes it all okay. They only got away from it because of that limitation.
I'm going to break this down a little bit because I appreciate the time-barred argument, but when we boil this down, Manchester City were already punished for that period, right? Manchester City breached financial fair play. They broke financial fair play rules, as did Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
And in 2014, they reached a settlement agreement, which is essentially a plea bargain for younger listeners, saying, okay, this happened, we will accept this punishment, and we will move on, okay? That part is not in question. What this whole case was about was whether their breach in 2014 was even greater, whether they misrepresented facts
lied.
In 2014, whether they lied to prosecutors or whatever, or not. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, if they did lie, then we should go back, reopen this monitoring period, and for a stretch, the next monitoring period, and punish them even more. This was UEFA's case.
You summed it up really well.
That part of it doesn't go away, but as Augie said, there's a point at which you need to move on.
I know, but if you lied and cheated 5 years ago, you still benefit from it now. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
you haven't really been punished for it.
I agree with all that, but if UEFA statute says there's a 5-year time limit on offences or alleged wrongdoing being punished, then their constitution is held up against the wall, really, because they can't take it any further. That's the issue, that, you know, legally, a great lawyer will always find a loophole, and if this is the way that Man City got off, the lawyers found the loophole. It's not even a loophole, it's a big gaping hole, isn't it, in UEFA statute, that if you have a 5-year time limit on offences. So I don't understand how UEFA, knowing this, could have gone to CAS with any confidence. They must have realised from the outset that they were going to lose this, because it boils down to legal definition, doesn't it? And that's simply what it is. It's not about right and wrong now. It's legal definition. If your legal statute says 5-year time limit, and this was dealt with in 2014, then Man City have every right to say, well, you know, too late, sorry. And if they've done wrong, they've done wrong. But still, this has been resolved now by CAS, and we have to move on, because it becomes like Brexit otherwise, doesn't it? You know, he said, she said, they said, that said. It's done with. Unfortunately for people that want FFP to stand up, it hasn't done.
Is there
any
way?
You're Man City.
Sorry, Ogie. Is there any way something can happen now, or this is just finished? This is over. There's nothing UEFA can do, or FFP, or the body that represents FFP. They can't go anywhere. This is over now.
This is it. The Court of Arbitration for Sport is the ultimate say in this. I mean, again, I think until we see the written reasons, I think we should withhold judgment on, because we don't know how much of it was time barred, and how much of it was not proven. You know, in the immediate, I think we can talk about the sporting effects, but there is no appeal to this. Even the idea that City were going to take it to a Swiss federal court if they weren't happy or whatever, you know, that was all still pie in the sky, because very uncertain. The Swiss federal court would have to agree to take the case and everything. That's all by the by. More broadly,
I do think.
Sorry, go ahead.
Let me ship it. I do think it's an opportunity now for, like, the European Club Association, the big clubs out there, the Liverpool, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Man United, etc., to maybe now, having seen how FFP hasn't worked as they wanted it to create, agree on their own rules, so the clubs and UEFA maybe collaborate and agree on a set of rules going forward which will work.
Why do you say FFP hasn't worked? The point of FFP was to make European football sustainable and investable. And this is where we should have a little sound effect for this, because it's my favorite stat. The year before FFP was introduced, European football as a whole, top flight clubs, lost 1.8 billion euros. The last 2 years, European clubs as a whole actually made money. That is an incredible turnaround in 7 to 8 years.
Yeah,
and that is down to financial fair play.
In terms of teeth and being able to punish clubs that have done wrong, it hasn't worked, has it? Which clubs have been on the wrong end of a UEFA punishment, apart from, you know, a few Turkish clubs and a couple of Italian clubs that have had the knuckles wrapped rather than properly punished? You know, Man City and PSG are the two big clubs that have, you know, that UEFA have struggled with over the years, and they've come through it unscathed.
They both got away with it. And I'm even saying that as a PSG fan myself, but we were lucky.
I think FFP will be reforming. There is a broader FFP argument independent of all this, right? So you're saying tougher rules or whatever. And frankly, from Manchester City's perspective, Manchester City have officially said all along that they're in favor of FFP.
Yeah.
And I think big clubs will be in favor of FFP for the rules, for the reasons that we know, right? You can't spend beyond your means. So if you have a lot of revenue, as these clubs have, then you'll be able to spend more, right? That's all good from their perspective.
Yeah.
Now, the conversation has been about new owners and what can we do FFP-wise to allow clubs to come in, to bridge that gap. Now that the European football landscape as a whole is actually investable and profitable, now that it is a real business, now that it is solid, should we allow people who come in to take advantage of this and say, yeah, listen, I want to breach FFP for 2 years. Here's my business plan. And then in 5 years, I'll break even. And I show that I have all the guarantees. There's something called a voluntary agreement,
yeah,
which clubs
which is
can
in
already,
place already.
Yeah, but which is actually very difficult to use because you can only do it either when there's a change of ownership or if you've never used one before. So I think they want to go further with this in relaxing this a little bit, encouraging the investment. Obviously, COVID-19 and what's happening this year is going to impact many things, so we don't know what the landscape is. But I think the way going forward is they're going to allow more of this. But, Mark, this alone, and coupled with tougher enforcement, this isn't going to solve the issue of polarization and inequality in European football, is it?
No. I mean, listen, the whole idea of FFP, from my point of view, was to ensure that the established elite didn't get pushed out of what they have become used to over the last 50 years. So Man City and PSG are the bad guys in this because they've kind of tried to upset the established elite. And now this gives the opportunity to other clubs, perhaps like Newcastle, if their takeover happens, as we think it might, that they will now be able to perhaps spend and disenfranchise the likes of Man United, of Juventus, of Bayern Munich. And that's what the big clubs don't want. There has to be scope for these clubs to grow. There has to be the opportunity for clubs to come, have the kind of the financial fairy tale, shall we say, that Man City and PSG have had. Otherwise, it just becomes a bit of a staid picture. But one thing you have to say, Liverpool are the champions of Europe right now, the champions of England, and they've done it without spending any money in the last 2 years. They've done it with a sensible business model. They've done it to balance the books. So it shows that you don't have to spend hundreds of millions of pounds to get to the top. It does help if you've got a historic base to work from, but you have to leave the door open for the likes of Man City and PSG, and perhaps Newcastle, and other clubs that may have money. I mean, we've seen other clubs fail. Look at Anji in Russia. They failed miserably because it didn't work. So at least the club, Man City want one thing. They've spent a lot of money, but their business plan and how they've run the club has been exemplary in terms of they've picked the right people, they've picked the right players. So it isn't all about throwing money at it and hoping it sticks. Some clubs have thrown money at it and been massive failures.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify is your no excuses business partner. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/gabjules. All right, Joel, Saturday night, Atalanta coming from 11 straight wins in all competitions, taking on Juve. This was the one. This is the match where we thought it's going to reopen Serie A, possibly. Atalanta were, I thought, unbelievable to watch. There's this thing which those nasty rights holders, of which we are one. I don't know if it was us.
No, but you
made them take it down. But
I
was able to
retweet. Yeah, it worked.
I was able to retweet it. It's since been taken down.
Okay.
Somebody played a spell of 8 minutes and 11 seconds, during which Juventus didn't have a touch in the opposition half, leading up to Duvan Zapata's opening goal.
Yeah.
Absolutely mesmerizing. But then two penalties. Two handballs, one to equalize the first time, converted by you-know-who, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is up to 28 goals in the season, one behind Ciro Immobile at the top of Serie A. And then another one in the 88th minute, which I think to most neutrals was really a kick to the gut.
Yeah, it was.
And it all goes out the window. Juve actually extend their lead at the top to 9 points because Lazio contrived to lose again. As they often do at this stage of the season. But that was something, though.
That was something from Atalanta. If you hadn't seen them play before, that was really the game where not only you would see them against great opposition, but also you would see what they're all about and what we've been discussing. And maybe a lot of people thought, oh, you're overhyping them or whatever. But the first half, especially, because I thought they lost a bit of intensity in the second half, which you can understand. But the first half, they were so magnificent in the way they pressed. And they're not running like crazy headless chicken. Is that what English people say? Is this not that? I think they're only the ninth team in Serie A that runs the most. So it's not about running everywhere and, you know, man marking people. It's running in a very clever and intelligent way on when you press, how you press, where you press. And as you said, Juve could not deal with it. They couldn't get the ball out. They had to play long on Dybala and Cristiano, which never worked. And that was fantastic. They lost a bit of intensity in the second half and I think Juve played better. My question to you first is, you Maurizio Sarri, and you know exactly what Atalanta are going to do, right? How are they going to press? How can Blaise Matuidi, who I love dearly, as you know, plays in a game like this, starts in a game like this, when he will be completely incapable of beating the press or coping with the press or even holding the ball up somehow to try to beat that press? Surely Pjanic, for example, and Bentancur and Rabiot, I guess, although his lack of aggression baffles me in a game like this. But it was, there was no way that Juve would beat that press.
So he made a big call, obviously, in dropping Pjanic, playing Bentancur in the playmaking position. So you're saying have another guy who's comfortable.
Don't you think in a game like this, if you wanted one game, one player under pressure on the ball to beat the press, would be Pjanic in all your squads?
I think that was the idea, but I think he also perhaps bottled it a little bit and said, let me go for two guys who are more athletic, more defensive, who can keep up with Atalanta, and then we'll get something, a long ball, Bonucci pass over the top. It never happened. Bonucci, who at the back, and De Ligt, both those guys are comfortable on the ball. I think his idea is, you know what, if they're going to come at us, I'll have those guys playing through the press. This is why these guys are here. They're good on the ball.
Yeah.
But they were never able to do that. I mean, it's easy to find demerits for Juve, and I don't think, I mean, Cristiano converted two penalties, had one shot, didn't feel like he did much lucky. Otherwise. Dybala, I thought, played well again. It's easy to find fault with Juve, but I think a lot of it was just because Atalanta played so well.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, he had the guts to make the big changes in the second half. You know, he substituted his entire front three, sent on Malinovsky, who of course made it 2-2, Pasalic, and you know, that made all the difference.
You wonder if Ilicic should have started that game. He didn't really look fit. It didn't really look right, especially when you see then Malinovsky's performance when he came on. And it's easier to come on like this for the last half hour or something. But it shows again that the 16, 17 players that Gasperini has that have made this squad and this team so competitive are just fantastic. You can change and even made the team better, as you said. And I don't know, obviously, for PSG's point of view, and the game is in a month time, I was really keen to watch them. I do think that if you manage somehow to block the two wings and
Robin Gosens wasn't there, who obviously I think is probably their, you know, one of their top three players right now.
Definitely.
All right.
Because then if you can keep them centrally, I know the Zapata goal came from a lovely pass from Papu, but obviously their main strength and the way they play is on the wing. So if you manage somehow to block that, then...
Although if they win set pieces, dangerous. They're also really good on set... Ridiculously good on set pieces too.
They are indeed. They're just fantastic. And,
all right. Elephant in the room is the two penalties. Now, it was interesting to see the reaction. Obviously, this game was Saturday night. There wasn't too much else going on. So a lot of people went in there. And, you know, the fact that Juve got two penalties, they immediately brought back all the stuff about Calciopoli. And I just want to make this very clear for people who kind of haven't been watching Serie A. Serie A, like La Liga, has adopted this very strict interpretation on handballs, okay? Whether you like it or not. And they've been very, very consistent. If your arm is away from your body 99% of the time, and the ball strikes it 99% of the time, we're going to take the discretion away from the referee. 99% of the time, we will call penalty. And they've been very consistent. And Juventus have been on the receiving end of this.
We saw against Milan, for example.
We saw it against Milan with Milan with Bonucci. We saw it with De Ligt. I think he's given away four penalties this season. So I know why people go and make those cracks about Juve and Calciopoli or whatever, but this isn't it, okay? Yeah. This doesn't apply. Yeah. You can debate whether it's the right interpretation or not, but one point I want to make very, very clear here. The reason they decided to take the discretion away is they were getting absolutely hammered by people afterwards who always complained about penalties. We in the media pointing out their mistakes, managers, presidents from teams always, oh, but that should have been a handball. That could have been, why did you give that one? Why didn't you give that one? So he said, screw this, learn to defend. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, right? All right, the first one, he starts with his hands behind his back. And then as he turns, his hand comes out. You should expect Martin de Roon, I think it's his third year in Serie A. Yeah. You should know. You should. I mean, I don't want to nitpick here, but you will get used to saying, keep your hands behind your back. And even if you, even as you turn, you can turn while keeping your hands behind your back. The Muriel one
is different because
that's different.
The position he's in. But I think where you're spot on is the consistency. At least it's all the same. For everyone, it's the same. It's a handball, it's a penalty, that's it, you move on. There's no like, oh, but this one was not given. They're all given anyway. So, and I've got nothing against that.
The second one just felt harsher because clearly he had no idea the ball was coming. The ball was moving away. I think you can, for those situations, you can put, because they're so rare, you can put an element of discretion
maybe,
in there.
And it was the 89th minute or 88th minute as well, which looked even more cruel. It looked for even more.
I tweeted out, you gotta be kidding me. Because
I know.
I thought, my God, like this is, you know, but it's not, look, the referee applied the laws of the game. Yeah. You know?
And I wanted them to win so badly, but Cristiano took the two pens really well, you know, against Golini, who's not the best on, you know, it's not Handanovic on penalties, but still, it's never easy to take two penalties in the same game.
I think Golini has never saved the penalty. Oh, right, like you say, I think it's something. Yeah. It's one of the longer streaks.
So it's the other extreme to Handanovic, but you know,
Golini, however, a very talented rapper. Go on YouTube.
Yes, that's
and
right.
Check
that's
it
very
out.
True.
Him and Kevin Prince Boateng, very different styles.
Very different styles.
If you're into that,
Memphis Depay as well. Again, different style, but you know.
Yeah, but I think
Golini's better,
a bit cooler than Memphis Depay, with all due respect. Although Kevin Prince is obviously cooler than both.
So this is over right now. There's surely no one will catch Juve.
I mean, I think it's a lot. Interplay Monday night. The Juve have they have Sassuolo who have sprung a lot of surprises. Very attacking.
True,
they don't care. They
can
drop points
as well
against Lazio.
But
you know, okay. So they lose both those games. It's still
And then they play Lazio, but
it's still
Lazio
a big
are
gap.
In now,
you know.
Doesn't look like they can do
it. I think it's over. I think it's nine in a row. But I'll tell you what, if Juve don't turn it around against Lyon, if they go out with a whimper in the Champions League, I think Sarri's position will be under review. All right, let's bring it back to the Premier League. Joining us now, ESPN senior writer James Ollie, on the back of the North London derby, Spurs coming from behind to beat Arsenal. James, before we get into that, I got to ask you. I know this has been overshadowed by Man City and all this other stuff, but it seems to me that the VAR and officiating in general is getting a lot worse. Last Thursday was sort of this horrendous day with
Thursday.
With the James Ward-Prowse dive, with the push on Harry Kane, right?
Yeah.
And Bruno Fernandes, most of all. Yesterday, you had the Sakho situation. I mean, I don't want to pick on people. People blame VAR. People blame referees. Some people are saying that the referees are tired.
Yeah.
Do you have any view on this about why it's so rubbish? Or going all the way back, Sheffield United and the goal line technology not working. How is it such a shambles in the wealthiest, best run league in the world?
I think it's a lot of it centres on the fact that fundamentally they don't want to be seen to be re-refereeing games. They want the man in the middle to make the final decision, whether that is go to the monitor and look at it again or, you know, however they choose to implement it. I think they're getting caught between trying to make sure that the referee out in the middle on the pitch is actually the final arbiter and achieving what is probably completely unrealistic, which is total and utter consistency all the time, 100%. You know, these things by definition are subjective, and the best refereeing has always factored in common sense, right? The best referees, if you talk to any players and managers, the best referees, yes, they like consistency, but also there's that application of common sense in certain situations. And the issue is there are going to be certain situations where common sense, technically there's a handball, the Harry Kane goal, technically that's handball, but practically everyone can see that clearly was not deliberate. That goal should have stood. But by the letter of the law, technically, if you're being consistent, and it's that sort of obsession with looking with consistency that I think is at the heart of the problem.
But hang on a second. I'm all for the man in the middle making the final decision. But I would hope that if the referee sees the Bruno Fernandes incident, again, that's why we have on-field reviews, he's going to change his mind. All right, let's move on to actual football.
Okay. How much football was there, James, yesterday at the Tottenham Stadium?
Well, it's the battle between 8th and 11th that kind of lived up to it. It lived down to its billing.
Who's happier?
Short-term Tottenham, but arguably longer-term Arsenal. I think if you know, Mourinho set a team up to win a game, or really to win a half of football, because the second half was quintessential Mourinho, wasn't it? Sit deep, try and hit on the break. The most damning thing for Arsenal was that this was a time-honoured game plan, and yet they still fell for it. You know, they still made the mistakes that Mourinho was waiting for Arsenal to make. And and really, you look at that team and think, well, for all the work that Arteta's doing in terms of their work, particularly with the ball, it's without the ball that they're still.
You mentioned that. I mean, if you're going to press, that's fine. You know that Arteta plays pressing football. If you're up against two strikers and there's always an out ball and the other team boots it long, you need to press a little differently once you realize that they're not going to try to play through you, right? Isn't that pretty obvious? Yeah, and win the second ball or whatever it is, whichever way you counter it? But why didn't Arteta do that?
Because you can hear from the touchline, you can hear Arteta talking them through the press. You can hear it. You can hear him telling the players who to press, where to press, when to go, when not to. And I think yesterday was probably a bit more of an example of where Mourinho's got them a little bit better drilled in that. He's had fractionally longer to work with them, but you suspect that he spends a lot more time on that aspect in training than Arteta would necessarily. I think Arteta's more possession-based. You know, what he wants, a possession-based style, obviously similar to Guardiola. I think Mourinho's happy to drill players defensively all day long, so I think they'd probably be a bit more, they're just a bit more attuned to it. And arguably, it probably comes down from a defensive point of view that Spurs have got marginally better defenders than Arsenal. But, you know, the piece I did for the site yesterday, I mean, both of those teams are a world away from being proper Champions League sides because of their defences. They've both got huge issues there at the back this summer. If you look at even at Tottenham, and the irony, of course, of a centre-back scoring the winning goal, you know, fantastic. When you think of, you know, Vertonghen's going to leave, you think Serge Aurier will probably go. They need cover for Ben Davies. Alderweireld's arguably not the defender he was a year or two ago. And then Arsenal, where do you start? You know, all three centre-backs yesterday, all three centre-backs for Arsenal gave the ball away in the opening 90 seconds under minimal pressure. And it really set the tone for the kind of errors that they were going to make at the back. And it was really no surprise that, you know, the two goals that they conceded, the types of goals that they conceded, because they were always coming, those errors.
All right, we're going to leave you with a bold prediction here, and we will hold you to this. We will hunt you down. Who's going to make the Champions League first out of these two teams?
And when? Which decade?
I have to say, it looks bleak for these two because of the wider.
Yes, that's why we're asking the question. Who's going to make the Champions League first? I know you're stalling for time here.
Which year?
Who is better placed to make the Champions League first and when? Oh, it's tough. We got him on the spot.
It's your debut. It's on your debut. You didn't have to sing, Tottenham, but you have to give a prediction.
Tottenham in 2 years.
Tottenham in 2 years. There you go, Jules. You don't like that.
We will remember. I don't mind. Listen, it's a great win for them. They were very pragmatic, I thought. But don't give me that 4-4-2 thing. What change did they create from that 4-4-2 formation? Tell me. Which what goal or chance came directly from the formation and from the way they played?
But they're bypassing the press.
Yeah, but so did they create anything?
Why are you
anything?
Going and tiring your players out and pressing them?
Did they create anything by bypassing the press anyway?
No,
but how much of the two German genius was all about, look, the 4-4-2 from Mourinho worked so well. It didn't work. They scored two goals on two mistakes that Arsenal gifted to them, right?
He's always so mean to Mourinho.
No, I'm not. And it's good on Mourinho. He was pragmatic and he was right. But that 4-4-2, you still hardly created anything for Kane. And the chance that he had at the end created to himself. The front two didn't really link up with each other. And then they scored two goals that were gifted by Arsenal. So don't give me the like, oh yeah, Mourinho outsmarted Arteta tactically. I don't think so.
Just very quickly on the press is that Arsenal conceded 9 goals in the 75th minute or later in matches. And I do think there's something in that. I think, you know, if it's fatigue, whether it's... It probably is fatigue, you'd say, given the timing of the matches. I think they're going to take a little bit of time to get the requisite fitness levels to go and press the way he wants for the whole game. We've seen it, you know. I know teams that press a lot tend to tire. You know, even the great Barcelona side used to do that under Guardiola. So, you know, it's not something unique to Arsenal. But I do think that's an indication that it's something that's very much a work in progress for them.
James Ollie, thanks so much for your debut.
Good debut, man.
Yes, well played, man. All right, that's more than enough North London derby and City and whatever else. Let's stick with City and some quick hits.
Let's go, Gab.
Of course, City, they can celebrate two things. They can celebrate another 5-0 win and mathematically securing their place in the Champions League next season. But they basically road graded Brighton. Raheem Sterling got a hat trick. Should we really count that last goal?
Of course, they all count. You know, players will tell you they all count. But you're right, he was outstanding to start with. I think it's his third hat-trick this season. And he on the third one, he sort of fell over. And as he was falling over, the ball sort of hit him and then still went in quite a funny way.
I love that he made a joke of it. So yeah, like, I should win the Puskas Award.
Exactly, for the most beautiful goal of the season. But good on him. Again, City... looked terrific, really. And we mentioned them in the last podcast as well, where they were fantastic. And again, it almost looked like their old self in many respects when we see them playing like this. This time it was Sterling and not David Silva. But when they play like this, it's fantastic. And Sterling should be very happy. It's probably the best season he's had in his career. So well done to him, no? Don't you think? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's never scored that many goals.
I think
He had a bit of a dip.
2 years ago is probably better, or even last year. But look, he's evolving into a different sort of player. Yeah. And he's living up to the hype.
Sheffield United spanked Chelsea 3-0, and it's a defensive horror show for Frank Lampard's crew. Gab, are you still going to argue that they don't have serious issues at the back, and should Blades fine, by the way, keep their Champions League hopes alive?
Well, after today's verdict, I would say probably not, because there'll only be 4 spots in the Champions League. Yeah. Look, I think... Chelsea have obviously conceded a lot of goals. This was absolutely terrible. The first goal, the double deflection, whatever. Yeah. But then Kurt Zouma, I don't know what the hell he's doing in the second goal. And the last one, Rudiger doesn't sort his feet out. I'm less concerned with a defender making a mistake, not sorting their feet out, because that's kind of a freak occurrence. Zouma, though, we've seen this before. Look, the weird thing is if you look at numbers, which I did... They have the fourth best expected goals conceded in the league.
Teams are very efficient against them. That's true.
And it's very, very close to the top. They have the second lowest shots conceded in the league. However, when they do concede shots, they concede high-quality shots, and they don't have a very good goalkeeper.
I was going to say, you mean their goalkeeper is really rubbish. And you're right.
Although I want to say, you know who also concedes a lot of high-quality shots? Liverpool and Manchester City.
Yeah, true.
In fact, they're roughly the same.
But so they have a better goalkeeper.
They have better goalkeepers, which is pretty simple. Yeah. They have probably better individual defenders, because I think I'd take Laporte and Van Dijk over anybody in Chelsea's back line. I think when you press the way they do, when you have an unsettled midfield, when you often rotate your players at the back, when you've got guys like Zouma, who I don't think is particularly good, or Christensen, who seems to have gone backwards the last couple of years, or... You know, Tomori in his first season of top flight, Rudiger hasn't had the best campaign. Yeah, you will concede goals, but I think it's something that can be fixed with one or two signings. I don't think it's, you know, it's an overall thing. Teams that press will give up stupid goals.
You know, my issue on that game was, and okay, defensively, and you've analyzed it perfectly, but going forward in that game, you've got Pulisic, who is with Greenwood and Fernandes, maybe the best player in the league right now, and you hardly use him. You don't even build your game plan around him, which I found he had hardly no service in that game, and I was like, why? The guy is electric. He's so much in confidence.
I think that's a very good point. And I think when Lampard said, you know, he's going to learn from this game, channeling the old, like, I never lose, I either win or I learn. Yeah. I think that's something he needs to address as well, what they did at the other end of the pitch. Yeah. Champions League draw was held on Friday, which was like ages ago.
I knew that was coming.
Jules, you predicted it.
Yeah.
I got to keep going with these Paris Saint-Germain UEFA conspiracies because, you know what? It's the perfect Paris Saint-Germain draw.
Is it? Is it, though?
No, it's not because you're playing Atalanta.
I know. And
be
I
afraid.
Want to say,
be very afraid.
I know. I am already. Even my oldest son yesterday said, on Saturday night when we were watching Atalanta Juve, he said,
we don't have to play those guys, do we, Papa?
Listen, it's a good draw in the sense that you avoid Bayern and, I don't know, Real Madrid and Barca, and you're on the other side of the draw. It's not a good draw because Atalanta are a hell of a team, as we described earlier. They exactly the team that can cause a lot of problems to PSG with the press. Although, if you think of one team that can beat the press, I think PSG have a lot of qualities to do that. But still, it would be
an
incredible
PSG
game.
And PSG play a friendly against Le Petit Muppet Show at the weekend and win 9-0?
Yeah, Le Havre. But you know what? They had two different teams for each half. They look quite sharp fitness-wise. And yeah, it was too easy. Okay. But listen, the game is in a month. By then, Atalanta might have lost half of their team through injuries. You don't know.
Yeah.
And they might be super tired because they will play a lot. So,
and maybe Neymar's sister will celebrate another birthday. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. Or hers is in March, I think. So, you know, it doesn't really count. But listen, it's a tricky draw. And I think all the PSG players know it. They watched the game on Saturday. They know what to expect. They will work hard
PSG.
On it. No. But we'll know. And then after that, it's Leipzig or Atletico. So, yeah, if you go through that, you've got a good chance as well, again, to go to the final. But I can't jinx it. I don't even want to talk about it until next month now. Gab, Jackie Charlton passed away at the weekend, which is very sad news. Please put him in context, especially for the younger listeners who...
Yeah, I mean, I think depending where you are age-wise, you remember him as a tremendous central defender for Don Revy's great lead side that obviously were successful in Europe and whatnot, playing alongside Norman Bite Your Legs Hunter. That was a team of Johnny Giles and Peter Lorimer and Billy Bremner and so on. But then he had another era as a manager, obviously managing the Republic of Ireland to tremendous heights in I think at least two World Cups, and he did it his way. He took Ireland to the first ever World Cup. You know, that was a team of Ray Houghton, Tony Cascarino, and a bunch of others. And he was a very imposing figure. He was a very funny, warm guy as well. I remember Andy Townsend telling me the story. The team were, and I know this plays into sort of every stereotype, but I think it was a night before a game. It's either the 90 or 94 World Cup. I'm going to guess 94, perhaps. And it's like 11 o'clock. Everybody's in bed. They're all nervous. And suddenly Jack Charlton sends somebody up to go and knock on all the players' rooms and tell him to come downstairs. And they were sponsored by Guinness. And they all had a drink downstairs to release the nerves in the before the game, which would be anathema to many, but obviously worked for them. I wish I could remember what specific game it was. So he had things like that.
Yes,
he was able to really connect with the players in many, many ways, and really a huge, huge figure. We've been talking about how great Real Sociedad were, but not since the restart. One win in eight and Champions League hopes dashed. They do have a Copa del Rey final to look forward to, but kind of expected
strange
a little
one.
More.
Yeah, and you remember before the restart, we said, okay, who's that break would benefit the most? The grafters, although Getafe haven't done particularly well either, or the ballers like Real Sociedad. And they've never started again. They've never restarted, to be fair to them. They were so poor. They made some mistakes defensively as well. I think the the mojo they had going forward had disappeared a bit with maybe the lack of fitness or that long break they had. Odegaard was on the bench, didn't even come on, for example, at the this weekend in their game against Granada, when he's been so good in the first half of the season until the break. And, you know, it's still a young team, so maybe that what happens. But it's a real shame because, in a way, they deserve for what they showed until the pandemic break, that they deserve maybe a Europa League spot, you know, something like that, as a reward of the season. And you said maybe the Copa del Rey is a Basque derby as well against Athletic Bilbao, who, on the other hand, are far more in form than Real Sociedad, and they won again at the weekend, and now are looking good for European places as well. So
it's a shame if they end up with nothing to show.
Yeah, it really is. Staying in Spain, Barcelona win against Valladolid, which means Real Madrid can't win the title until later this week, Gab. And this is the last week of La Liga, with two games, or three in Real Madrid's case, for each team. It's 3 points, and Leo Messi reaches the 20 assist mark to go with his 22 goals. But there's not much else to cheer, is there? It was not a really good game.
No, it was. And Arturo Vidal scored early, and a goal created by Lionel Messi. Yeah. It's funny, Messi... goals numbers are well down this season, but in some ways he's been so much more influential than in years past. And he's obviously provided a lot of assists. He changed it around. He played a back three with Sergio Roberto in there. You can tell what he's trying to do because you know he listens to his podcast.
Yeah, of course.
Last week we had Sid saying, "Oh, it's great that you're playing, you know, Griezmann and Suarez with Messi and behind, but you lose out in terms of width.
Yeah.
So hey, let me go with a back three so that Semedo and Jordi Alba can bomb up the pitch." I kid, obviously. But the other thing in this is he gave Suarez a breather. I'm assuming Suarez had started every game since the restart. He's 32 years old, or 33 even. Maybe that's why.
And he didn't look fit against Espanyol either.
He doesn't look fit. Yeah. He doesn't look right.
Yeah.
Griezmann, of course, injured now.
Picked up an injury, quite early on.
Quadriceps, I think.
Yes, so, I think it is. So he's out until the Champions League comes back, hopefully.
I mean, I think this is going to end with a whimper. But I'm not going to fault Setien for trying different formations.
No, you're right.
Trying different things at this stage of the season. Leicester City managed to throw away a lead against Bournemouth to lose 4-1. Is this them slipping out of the Champions League?
We've said, Gav, haven't we, for weeks now, that they will finish fifth, that we kind of saw this coming. They make mistakes like they didn't make in the first half of the season. I mean, if you haven't seen the Bournemouth first goal, the penalty, and the way the penalty came between Kasper Schmeichel and Ndidi. I mean, Ndidi has nothing to do with it, but Schmeichel hitting a goal kick pretty much on the back of his own player on the edge of the box, then Callum Wilson get the ball, it's a foul, it's a penalty. And
but it was Ndidi who fouled him.
Yeah, but the ball, yeah. What I mean by that is the ball hitting Ndidi is nothing. Oh, yeah. It's not Ndidi's fault. But then, he makes that foul. It's just, I don't know, it's the way they imploded at Bournemouth is quite incredible, really. But they didn't play well against Arsenal either.
Soyuncu's red mist as well.
Soyuncu with a red card because he lost it and kicked Callum Wilson. I'll come back on the red card. I don't like the three at the back. I don't know why Rogers changed that. I thought their back four was really strong with Ndidi. You can even bring another defensive midfielder if you want. I don't get the back three at all. It was against Arsenal, it was really poor. They got lucky to get a point. Against Bournemouth, okay, they were in control until halftime, but I didn't think the fluidity was there either. And for the red card, you know what? I've never understood why, as a player who just conceded a goal, you want to prevent the other team from getting the ball in the net to bring it back on the... the spot in the middle.
Because you want a time waste. You don't want him to take a quick kickoff.
But then make your way really, really slow to the centre of the pitch and you waste time that way.
Exactly.
Why? And every time you see them fighting over the ball, and then often it's a yellow card or a red card or a little fight, and just leave them do it and then walk very slowly to the ball. And
so Yunchu's been phenomenal this season.
Yeah, it's a big miss.
Obviously let himself down there. But wait, a quick shout out to them, like your technical players. I don't know where Brooks has been all season. I know he's had injuries, he's been out of the side. But man, that guy.
Oh, that nutmeg at some point on the right side. Yeah, he's so good. He's so good. Let's hope that he can stay injury fit and with a better a team with a bit more momentum, you know, it could do better. Liverpool are held by Burnley 1-1. Gab, it was always going to be tough to maintain momentum and motivation after being already crowned. But they need three wins now to get the point records. In their three remaining games against Arsenal, Chelsea and Newcastle, are they going to do it? And by the way, that draw meant they could not go 19 wins in 19 home games in the season, which, you know, will be another record?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't think they're going to win all three games. Chelsea obviously have a lot to play for. Arsenal will play the way they play, and they can spring a surprise. And, you know, if Newcastle play like Steve Bruce's preferred 8-1-1 formation.
Yeah, they would concede five.
I don't know. Like, I don't care about the record. What
Why?
They did stands.
Why don't you care?
Because it's a ridiculous season that Liverpool had. Records come and go. They were fortunate in some games.
I know, we had that debate the other
games.
Day.
I think it's going to be very, I think it's a really, really big ask. I didn't think they were going to set the record. I certainly didn't think, though, they were going to drop points here. But yeah, this was a game that we had all penciled in for 3 points.
Yeah.
12-year-old boy has been detained by police after sending racist messages via social media to Wilfried Zaha, who shared them, and they were horrendous. Jules, I don't quite know what to say, so I'll let you handle this.
I feel appalled completely, and I think it's an absolute disgrace. 12 years old, and you send photos of the Ku Klux Klan and saying to Wilfried Zaha, if you play well against us, I'm going to come to your house dressed as a ghost, and pretty much this is what's going to happen. It's just...
I mean, to be fair, what we know is that it was sent from his account, yeah, and he was detained. Okay. It could have been a family member, could have been a parent, could have been some sicko hacking his account. I don't know, but... It's just horrendous. And, you know, what I find most disturbing is, and look, I'm not saying these things are different, but when you have somebody in the stands shouting racist abuse, right, at a player, we all get bent out of shape and, yeah, and whatever. And rightly so. We all get angry. People make the point like, oh, find the club, blah, blah, blah. Here, you have some degenerate doing stuff like this. And players of color deal with this crap on a far more regular basis.
On a daily basis, yeah.
And you know what? In some ways, look, neither should be happening. But some guy in the stands racially abusing you versus somebody who you don't know. You don't know if this guy's a psychopath who will come to your house.
Yeah.
That is just as terrifying, if not more.
But it's disgrace. Extreme, you know, the disgrace is that social media won't do anything to make this not happen again. You can still open as many accounts as you want from anywhere in total anonymity. And I
don't think it's quite as anonymous as
no, not in this
say,
case, but still, but you've got a lot of abuse that came from like account where you can't trace who it is behind and stuff like that, and that should not happen. Napoli and Milan battled to a 2-2 draw, but Gab, I got the sense from both teams that they seem in pretty good form. That was a pretty good game, I thought. It was quite entertaining.
I thought it was a very good game. I thought Milan got a little bit lucky with the penalty at the end.
Atalanta, it's a similar kind of...
Yeah,
in the sense that Napoli dominated like Atalanta did and still...
But I think in the end, he gets the ball. He gets the ball quite clearly. Bonaventura's trying to shield the ball for the penalty.
Yes.
Ibra had a quiet game. Maybe this Ibra obsession will move on. But like, I can only be impressed by Rino Gattuso, because, you know, it may not be the most sparkling form of football. I think there's a ceiling to his football.
Yeah.
But he's got everybody on message, everybody going. You know, this was a battle for fifth place, and both teams, I thought, played really well.
And just a shout-out to my boy Theo Hernandez, who scored another lovely goal and just proven to be Milan's best player this season.
Ismail Benacer in the build-up.
Ismail Benacer is my boy as well, but...
In that pass was a bit special. True. And of course, Rebic in between setting him up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Real Madrid play this evening, but Gareth Bale was in the headlines again for wearing his face mask like a sleep mask and pretending to snooze as an unused substitute. Jules, I thought the guy's just making a joke, but many didn't see the funny side, and we had the usual two gangs of Muppets coming out, some people crucifying him, and then the other ones. The people who never watch Real Madrid, no idea what's going on, but hey, he's Welsh, he scored a goal in the Champions League final, so they defend him to the hilt.
Yeah.
To me, it's just a joke.
It was a joke from him as well, and he was very jokey. At first on the touchline, well, he was in the stand, but you know, he's drinking an orange juice, laughing, this and that. Then he put his face mask as a sleep mask to pretend he was asleep for a few seconds, and then he got really frustrated. You could tell when the fifth and last sub came on and it was not him. I mean, Zidane pretty much used every single attacking option that he had on the bench apart from Gareth Bale in a game like this, so you can understand his frustration. I tweeted the photo on Saturday morning, and he exploded on my timeline. All your Welsh in-laws have to go. No, it's not so much that. We can't forget that he did some really good things for Real Madrid, okay? We can't forget either, and we're not doing it, that his attitude at times and his relationship with injuries has been a bit weird, right, and dodgy, right? We can't also ignore the fact that he was for sale and that Real Madrid wanted to sell him and that Zidane wanted to sell him. And really, if you ask Zidane, would you rather selling him or keeping him? He would say, I would rather selling him. So we know that's the truth. I still don't think that Gareth Bale is helping himself by doing things like that on the touchline where he knows that everything is filmed. And I don't know. Even if it was a joke, I think he could have avoided a few headlines there and there, basically. Well, finally, Gab, Atletico Madrid have 2 goals disallowed, go down to 10 men and still score late through Diego Costa to beat Betis 1-0 to seal their place in the Champions League next season, which was not a given 6 months ago. You know, they had a very slow start of the season. So Cholismo is alive and well.
Yeah, I go further and say Cholismo 2.0 is alive and well because, okay, this was, I thought, a slightly more progressive performance. I only got the one goal that stood. Both VAR decisions I thought were correct. The handball and the build-up and the offside for the Morata goal. But Morata did take the goal really well. That did happen. I tell you what, I wonder if maybe they won't have something to say about the Champions League.
Yeah,
I know they're on Paris Saint-Germain's side of the draw. But,
no, I know. But
you know, having put this to bed, he can work on a few things and I wouldn't want to be playing them.
No, Marco Sorrente looks like a great finding as a second striker.
Yeah.
It's really solid.
All right, that brings us to an end of an eventful Gavin Jules podcast.
Today really flew, didn't it?
Congratulations to Manchester City.
Again, yeah.
We'll be seeing you in the Champions League
next year and the year after.